everyone, and welcome to At the Drive-In. I'm Tamira, and this is a podcast where I talk about movies from the 30s to the 60s, and I look at things such as the plot, the themes, the characters, any funny anecdotes, and pretty much anything worth mentioning about the movie. Today I'll be discussing my first and definitely not my last Alfred Hitchcock movie. It's perhaps one of his lesser-known movies, although honestly with Hitchcock, none of his movies are very far from being lesser-known than others. It's called Rope, and it was released in 1948. It stars James Stewart, Farley Granger, and John Dow. Now, I have to say, I definitely like this movie. It's probably one of my favorite Hitchcock movies, although some people really don't like it. And, you know, I guess that's fine, because everybody has a different taste and everything, but I don't know. I really enjoyed it. Anyhow, so let's get into the summary of this movie, which is pretty wild. Anyhow, So it starts off with two men strangling a man in their apartment. And we learn that these two men are Brandon Shaw and Philip Morgan, two really, really smart men who used to attend Harvard University. And the man they're strangling is a former peer called David. So they murder David as a, quote, intellectual exercise. They think they're absolutely brilliant. And so they think they can get away with the perfect murder with nobody discovering them. This is particularly one of the men who thinks this throughout the whole movie, and it's Brandon. And so basically, you're just going to find out, you're just going to see the whole justification behind the murder is absolutely wild, but we're going to get into that later. Plus, it's also very interesting. So, if murdering a guy wasn't enough, they decide to stuff David's body in a wooden chest, knowing fully well that soon guests would start arriving to their apartment as they had organized a little party for that evening, right? Okay, as if murdering a guy and then stuffing him into a wooden chest wasn't bad enough, they decide to replace the table that the guests would be eating off with the wooden chest hiding the body. So this story is kind of intense, if you couldn't tell already. And yeah, I should probably mention that the person who's making most of these decisions about where to put the body and everything is Brandon, whereas Philip is not very comfortable. He's clearly nervous with the idea of putting the body there. He's really not into it. Anyhow, we're going to see that a lot, which is Brandon is definitely the more commanding one, and Philip is already super nervous about what they've done. So the guests start arriving, and all the guests that have been invited are somehow associated or related to David. So there's his old best friend, Kenneth. They're not best friends anymore. And then there's his girlfriend, Janet. And then his father and aunt. And finally, his prep school teacher, Rupert Cadell, who's played by Stewart. So while they're helping themselves to the food, which is, you know, coincidentally on a chest hiding a dead body, just a detail, Philip decides that he doesn't want to eat any chicken. And for some reason, this is a really big deal. I mean, everyone makes a really big deal out of it. And Brandon has to, like, come up with this, like, story to explain why Philip doesn't want to eat chicken. And he talks about how Philip once strangled a chicken. And Philip denies this vehemently. Like, he's so adamant that this didn't happen. And this strikes Rupert as really odd because Rupert had actually been there when Philip had strangled a chicken, so he knows that Philip is lying, and that's like the beginning of the slight suspicion on Rupert's behalf. And okay, this is interesting because Rupert unknowingly has played a very significant role in the thought process behind the murder. So when they were still in school, when he was their teacher, he would often talk about Nietzsche's concept of the Superman, and this concept of the Superman as being the goal that humanity should set itself. He also discussed Thomas Penson de Quincey's essay on the art of murder. Brandon invites Rupert because he thinks that Rupert will be the only person apart from him and Philip that will appreciate the murder, and he'll look at it as a work of art because he's spoken about it before like that. He doesn't tell Rupert immediately, though, about the murder, which, I don't know, I guess it surprises me, but I guess he wanted to hear more about what Rupert thought, and he would hope that Rupert would talk a bit more about his views on murder and Nietzsche. And Rupert does not disappoint. In that cozy little apartment surrounded by people who just want to eat and drink and have a good time, he starts talking about the benefits of murder, saying how it would solve unemployment and poverty. And then he starts going into pretty gruesome, I mean, for the 40s, and especially for a nice little casual dinner party, he starts going into gruesome detail about how there are different categories of how one should be killed according to who they are and their profession. So He has a particularly special category of death by slow torture reserved especially for hotel clerks, bird lovers, small children, and tap dancers. So if you're any of those, you're not in for a good time. He also talks about how murder should be an art committed by superior beings. To this, Brandon excitedly adds that the superior people would simply be killing inferior people whose lives are not worth anything anyway, so Brandon's pretty psyched to hear Rupert talking about how certain people should die. So that just convinces him even more that Rupert would understand what he did to David. Rupert is just a swell guy to have at a party. I mean, really, just imagine having this one guy talking about how people should be allowed to kill other people because they're superior. I mean, that's sure to spice things up with no booze needed at all. Anyhow, this whole talk of murder excites Brandon, as I said, and it finally gives him this proof that Rupert would admire his work of art. David's father, on the other hand, is not into this conversation. He confronts Rupert and Brandon about who are those so-called superior beings who should be allowed to kill. And Brandon, I kid you not, this guy literally says,
"Oh, well, me, Philip, and Rupert."
I think it's safe to say that Brandon just has a tiny little ego, you know? Just tiny. Not arrogant at all, huh? And here's the thing. Brandon really thinks he's untouchable. You know, after committing a crime, he really thinks he can get away with it. So he feels really safe. And he's super not subtle about what has happened. So legit, when his first guest comes and he finds out that they're serving champagne, he says, "Oh, we're drinking champagne? Is it somebody's birthday?" And Brandon straight up says, "You might say it is quite the opposite." I mean, how is that for subtlety, huh? Just forget about perfecting the art of murder. Maybe perfect the art of discretion first and then move on to greater things like murder and who knows what else the Brandon has in store, really. So after Brandon has really modestly said that him, Philip, and Rupert are so absolutely superior to everybody that they're allowed to kill, he continues explaining that the superior people are the people who are so culturally and intellectually superior in every way that they are beyond moral concepts such as right and wrong and evil and good. He says that those concepts were created for the ordinary, inferior man because he needs them to survive. David's father refrains, although I really don't know how he doesn't say, like, "What the hell is wrong with you guys?" You know, he says, like, I don't know if you guys are serious, but I don't like this conversation. And he leaves the room. So as the party continues, people start getting a bit more worried about David because he's not showing up. And he's this pretty punctual guy who would definitely let them know if he was late or something or if he wasn't showing up in the end. And during this whole wondering where David is, Rupert has his eye on Philip, who he's noticed has been drinking way too much, and he's looking pretty rough. He's visibly jittery and nervous, so Rupert tries to quiz him on David's whereabouts, with Philip obviously saying he doesn't know him, but he gets agitated. He's like, "How would I know, you know?" Really, in a really not subtle way as well. David's mother gets in touch with David's father because she's very worried that David hasn't phoned or showed up or anything. After hearing this, David's father decides to leave. But before he leaves, Brandon gives David's father a bunch of books he promised he'd give him. And to tie up the books together, Brandon, because he's a psychopath, used the same rope he had used to strangle David.
So David's father was unknowingly holding
the object used to kill his son. Is it absolutely so disturbing? And yeah, I'm not the only one who's disturbed by that, because when Philip sees that what Brandon's done, he nearly loses his mind. I mean, which is understandable if you ask me, because that's on another level of dark. Anyhow, after that super disturbing little event, everyone decides to leave as well after David's father. And as Rupert goes to leave, he is handed the wrong hat by the maid. Before giving it back, he manages to see David's initials printed on the inside. And, you know, this really sets the alarm bells ringing.
So Rupert definitely knows something is up and that it's not good.
After everyone leaves, Philip and Brandon get into an argument. I mean, at this point, Philip is pretty drunk. And he's also scared shitless because he is sure that they're going to be found out. And also he's super not happy about the little rope trick thing that Brandon just pulled. And then Brandon is really pissed off because Philip was acting really suspiciously and he was making it real obvious that something was up, you know? But before they continue arguing for much longer, Rupert calls them again, saying that he had forgotten his cigarette case behind, which he had not, by the way. Anyhow, he lingers and he asks for a drink, and then he starts theorizing about David's disappearance. Brandon encourages Rupert a little bit as he starts describing a hypothetical murder. And then once they've reached, you know, that kind of awkward lull in the conversation, Brandon says that they have to get ready because they are going to go on a trip to Connecticut. And as Brandon is talking, Rupert, with his back towards Philip and Brandon, he's slowly taking the rope out of the pocket because he managed to get the rope from David's father. And he's, you know, he's feeling and everything. And he turns out really slowly and he starts making a conversation really casually. But all the while, he's like playing a little bit with the rope. And when Philip sees what Rupert is holding in his hands, he goes hysterical. He starts saying like, he knows. And then he grabs his gun that had been placed on the table and he starts blaming Brandon for it. Rupert manages to tackle the gun out of his hand and he says that he's going to look in the wooden chest. Brandon starts protesting, asking him if he's crazy or something. And Rupert says, man, I sure hope I'm crazy. I sure really, really hope that I'm crazy right now. So to nobody's surprise, Rupert discovers David's body. Brandon starts justifying the murder, referring to the conversation they had before about superior people being able to kill inferior people. The whole time, Rupert is just looking at him like with this face of shock and like as if he's just rethinking his whole life. And Rupert acknowledges that he had said those things, but that Brandon had given his words a completely different meaning that he had ever dreamed of. So he blames Brandon for twisting his words into a cold, logical excuse for a murder. This is where I start questioning Rupert's character a little bit, because, listen, there really is not a way you can twist what Rupert was saying. I mean, he was literally saying that people who are superior should kill ordinary people because they're inferior. That's literally what he was saying. How could Brandon twist that to make it into something worse, you know? I don't know. Anyhow, I'll come back to that later because it's interesting. So in his little monologue at the end, Rupert talks about how he has realized that every person has the same right to live, work, exist as a separate individual. And he asks Brandon how he dares say that there are few people who are superior.
Even though Rupert was saying exactly that about like 30 minutes ago, people could change their minds pretty quickly, especially if there's a murder involved.
To round off his little speech at the end, he tells Philip and Brandon that society is going to punish them for what they did. And that they're going to get what they deserve, which is that they're going to die. Then Rupert goes to the window and he fires 3 shots to track the police. The final scene of the movie shows Philip, Brandon, and Rupert not talking. They're just kind of standing. And you can hear very clearly the bustle on the street of people wondering where the shots came from. And then you hear the distant sirens. And that's how it ends. There's just a really still shot of all the noise, but then the room being very still. And that's the end of the movie. I think this is just one hell of a movie. I mean, from the crime itself, to the justification, to the way the movie was shot, to the intensity of the 3 main characters, I just think it's one hell of a ride. I loved this movie when I watched it and was surprised actually to hear that it wasn't a very big hit when it came out, although I understand that to a certain extent because of things that we're going to discuss in a bit, but that also nowadays people don't really like it very much, you know? I mean, I guess it's quite particular and it's disturbing, but I thought it was really good. Anyhow, the movie was based off of the 1929 novel of the same name by Patrick Hamilton. Many people might criticize this movie for seeming way too unrealistic and exaggerated. Like, nobody would think that. Nobody would think them so superior that they transcend morals. Like, that's too much. That's too unrealistic. It's too fictional, right? Well, the play was actually based off the actual murder of a 14-year-old boy by 2 students in the University of Chicago in 1924 who believed exactly what Brandon and Philip believed. Don't they say reality is more crazy than fiction? Or that, where do you think fiction comes from. It's totally based on reality. Reality is absolutely insane. You know, who knows what's happening in every house and in every place and to every human. It's insane. Anyhow, the fact that it's based on an actual thing makes it so much more disturbing. Although obviously they've taken some artistic liberties during the production and the shooting of the movie. This was Hitchcock's first movie in Technicolor, and it's well known for taking place in real time, which basically means that events are portrayed at the same time as which the characters experience them. The movie was made to look like only a single shot by shooting very long takes, usually 10 minutes or more, and prop men had to quietly remove furniture to allow space for the huge Technicolor camera, and then put the furniture back as it was. And the actors had to follow very specific cues and follow very, very specific order in their movements. And apparently, James Stewart found this constant attention given to the cameras and the shot and the staging to be exceedingly exasperating. And he said that the cameras are being rehearsed more than the actors themselves. This was one of Hitchcock's movies experimenting with limited setting. The whole movie, it brought from a first shot of a street at the beginning. The whole movie takes place in one room. Rope can be seen as the foundation for a rear window, which was to come out in 1954, and take place in one room with actually James Stewart as well starring as the protagonist. The importance of maneuvering the camera was paramount in this movie. So, for example, take the very first scene. After Brandon and Philip kill David and hide his body, the camera doesn't move at all while they have the conversation, stays in exactly the same place. But as they start moving towards the kitchen, the camera follows at the exact same height and steadily along as they make their way to the kitchen. And by doing this, the viewer of the movie becomes complicit in the murder because they're at the same height of Brandon and Philip and they're definitely part of the conversation. So the camera really plays a fundamental part in this movie and in the way it moves and everything. And as we all know, Hitchcock was very well known for his cameos in his movies. And in this movie, it was definitely tricky for him to have a cameo because it was all set in one room. So if he had a cameo, it'd be pretty obvious. And he's the master of subtlety. So there is a film expert that says that Hitchcock is one of the people who is walking on the street in the opening scene, but this isn't exactly confirmed. However, his more direct, but also, of course, subtle cameo can be seen at 55 minutes and 19 seconds into the movie, where you can see in the background, as Janet and Kenneth are having a conversation, a red neon sign with the silhouette of Hitchcock's profile. Listen, I've stared intently at this scene. I've stared intently at the circle around where Hitchcock is supposed to be, and I cannot see it. I don't know. I don't know why I can't see it. I mean, people must be so observant to be able to actually have seen that in the first place and then recognize it, because I swear I've looked at it for a pretty long time and I can't see it. But I don't doubt that it is in fact Hitchcock's cameo and it is silhouette, but I just can't see it. I mean, I don't know. I have to look at it even more carefully because I really want to see it. Now, just to analyze this movie a bit more, because this movie is just really, really worth taking a peek at, because it has these various layers behind the actual plot of the movie, behind the actual thing that you're seeing on the screen the whole time. There's so many layers to it. So it's like an onion. It's like an onion. We need to peel the layers back, and here we go. So what is particularly striking about the opening scene is the fact that it starts off with the shot of an open street in Manhattan on a sunny day, and then all of a sudden it focuses on these windows that have the blinds down, and suddenly you're looking into the room and you see David being strangled in this dark room. This is definitely meant to disconcert and confuse the viewer. I mean, they're suddenly moving from this calm and peaceful outside sunny street into this dark, gloomy murder scene. And it's a way to say how anything could be happening indoors. In every building, in every flat, in every single room, something extraordinary or absolutely horrific can be taking place, and we would have absolutely no idea. Walking down that sunny street, we just have absolutely no idea what's happening in every building and every room surrounding us. So it's definitely supposed to creep the viewer out and make them feel really uncomfortable and uncertain about anything that's going to happen. It's going to keep them on their toes, basically. Now, a new thing that this movie does is that the viewer starts off having actually witnessed the murder, and the viewer knows exactly who the murderers are. We know exactly who the murderers are. And this was quite new because usually you follow the good guy in the movies. You follow him being approached with the case of the murder, and then you follow him or her into this adventure of who committed the murder. But here we are, having just seen these two guys strangle this guy to death. And it almost makes us allies in it. It says we know the dirty secret, but nobody else knows, you know, and we're not saying anything. So in a way, we're a little guilty. And that's exactly what Hitchcock wanted. We are part of the murder. Even if we don't want that, we're still part of it, you know, and we can't do anything about it. Another thing that's quite interesting and striking about the movie is the murders themselves, because they're not exactly what we'd expect. People have this notion that murderers are low lives and seedy people, and you see them and you're like, that person could definitely kill another person. Like, they have that look, right? Obviously with a lot of prejudices, because I don't think people should be thinking about that about other people. But anyhow, here we're presented with these two clean-cut, sharply dressed, and very intelligent men. Now, the fact that they give off this really clean and sophisticated air, but in reality, them being murderers, it's meant to mimic the message of the first scene. Just like you can never tell from the outside what is happening within a building, you can't tell from the looks of the person what they're capable of doing. So again, the viewer is placed in a place of uncertainty, of discomfort, and even almost of guilt, really. Throughout the movie, there is the facade of politeness, of a good conversation, of a nice and casual party. Although, of course, we know that it's definitely not that. But we are almost tricked into getting caught up in this polite and proper facade that is presented by having this dinner party. But all the while, underneath, there's this lurking tension and animosity that you can definitely tell if you just look at it a little closer and listen. So, for example, there's the crime I'm committed, of course. That's definitely a lot of tension. But then there's the tension between Janet and Kenneth, for example, who used to be lovers. And then, of course, there's the tension between Janet and Brandon, who also used to be lovers. And then she's really angry at Brandon because he invited Kenneth and she thought that he did it out of a place of malice. And it's making everything really awkward, to be honest. And then you have the discomfort of David's father at the conversation that's taken place. Now, this underlying tension is briefly exposed when Philip accidentally breaks a glass he was holding out of panic when David's aunt mistakes Kenneth for David. It calls to mind the fact that any object that you can see in that room, so for example, any of the spoons, forks, knives, candles, glasses, anything can quickly turn into a violent object, an object that could actually be used to kill somebody. Now, the broken glass symbolizes this sudden violence that you don't expect, but that could come at any moment. And it's meant to parallel the object that was actually used to kill David, which is the rope, which is in itself is a very innocent object, you know, but this innocent object turns into a weapon of murder. And then it makes the viewer even more uncomfortable because suddenly anything that room could be used as a weapon to kill somebody. So we're basically just here feeling really uncomfortable. Then, of course, comes the infamous and super intense conversation about murder and Rupert's very particular views, which draw attention to the essence of the crime committed by Brandon and Philip. As I mentioned previously, Rupert refers to the idea of the Superman, which was first conjured by Nietzsche. And it's basically about how some people who are superior should be allowed to kill other people who are inferior because the people who are superior are so intellectually better that they almost transcend such moral concepts as good and bad. Now, listen, whether he likes it or not, Rupert is inextricably linked to the crime committed. Even if unwillingly, he has been made into an ally of the murder just by the fact that Brandon was certain that Rupert would approve of what he was doing. I mean, if he had reason to believe that, then Rupert was definitely not giving the right impression. Rupert was the one who had initially placed those dangerous ideas of superiority and inferiority into the heads of Brandon and Philip when they were young and at an impressionable age. In a way, Rupert is just not an admirable character. Even though he is presented as a hero at the end who does in a sense, redeem himself. I say that in quotations because I don't personally believe it. But anyhow, when he finds out about the murder and he does everything in his power to bring justice to David, which would basically get Brandon and Philip killed in the near future. Now, the whole time, Rupert speaks with full conviction about Nietzsche's ideas and talks openly about how he thinks certain people should be allowed to kill and how some people should be killed and in the certain way that they should be killed, which, you know, quite frankly, isn't very disturbing in graphic detail. Anyhow, Rupert plants that idea into Brandon's head about the superiority and being able to kill. And I personally think that he's not entirely blameless. And okay, true, you might say that he wasn't actually the one who committed the murder, he didn't kill anybody, but I really believe that sometimes words can be, especially coming from a figure such as a teacher, who is somebody who is admired and respected, and who can have a big, big influence on the way that students think and start interpreting. And now this is going to be a bit hard to explain, and it's probably going to come out really the wrong way. So please don't think that I'm siding with the people who committed a murder, because let's all agree that murder is bad. I don't have much respect for Rupert, because at the end of the day, he is all talk, which in this case is a really good thing, because if he wasn't all talk, he'd be committing murders left and right. But he doesn't, although he does talk openly and with a lot of conviction and with full confidence about Nietzsche's ideas and these ideas of being allowed to kill and everything. Now, I'm not saying in any way that what Brandon did is good. Obviously, it's without saying that the idea of someone being superior to somebody else and having almost the right to kill them is absolutely atrocious in every sense of the word, and I don't have to say that that's just plain wrong, but I'm saying, at least Brandon, who really believes what Rupert was saying, who really believes those ideas that Nietzsche presents about the Superman and everything, at least he truly sticks to his beliefs and he delivers, even if it's the most atrocious thing possible. He believes and he delivers, right? Now, as I said, that's not a good thing. That's really not a good thing. But as opposed to Rupert, who's just talking, and in the end, when it comes to it, he's backs out all of a sudden. I don't know. I don't think Rupert is exactly blameless in all of this. And honestly, I think it's just really easy to talk and be really confident when it's all in theory, but then in practice, then it's totally no way, I would never do that. You know, it's very easy to do that. Again, this sounds very wrong, but I just think that it's important to point out, because Rupert could potentially be viewed as a hero, but he's really part of the crime as well. Even if he didn't actually physically commit the murder, he's still part of it, whether he likes it or not. And I just don't understand how he could be talking with so much conviction about Nietzsche's ideas and how much he agrees with it, when in the end he would never dream of acting. That's his exact words. He said, "I would never dream of doing anything like that. It just doesn't make any sense. Like, how could you be talking with so much conviction about killing people and you would never be able to, you'd never be willing to do it?" You know, it's a bit of a contradiction on his side. So Rupert isn't exactly an admirable character, in my opinion, even though, of course, he does seek justice, and he obviously is commendable for that. But anyhow, let's just keep that in mind. I mean, that's just my opinion, but anyhow, I just think it's important to point out. Those are a few comments I wanted to mention, which apply to the movie as a whole, as it gradually unfolded. But now to look into more concrete things, such as themes. So one of the themes is that of art. Now, Brandon refers to murder as an art. Brandon refers to always wanting to be a better artist than he was, and he claims that murder is creative. Whereas, if you really think about it, well, you don't really have to think about it that hard, but murder is in fact the opposite of creation, and what people such as artists, musicians, and sculptors do, which is create. Murder destroys. It ends. It finishes. It annihilates. And here you can really get a peek into Brandon's warped mentality when he thinks that killing somebody is a form of creation. Brandon is also obsessed with this idea of the perfect murder. Brandon is a perfectionist, and throughout the whole evening, he tries to be the best at everything. The best host, the best talker, the best murderer, even the best matchmaker between Janet and Kenneth. Here first, David as the perfect victim, because in Brandon's eyes, he is a nobody who just occupies space and therefore was a perfect candidate to be murdered. And his perfectionism is obviously off-kilter. He wants to be perfect at everything, even if that includes killing someone. And in his mind, he turns murder into an art so that he can feel like he's the perfect artist in a masterpiece, in a work of art. You know, he's a little psycho, really. Now to discuss a theme that is very prominent in the movie, which is that of homosexuality. Now, one of the reasons why this movie wasn't a big hit when it came out in 1948 was because of the discomfort that some people felt upon seeing the interaction between Brandon and, which was quite understandably non-platonic. Now, it is undeniable that Phillips and Brandon's relationship is presented as something more than platonic. Just the way they face each other super closely, and when they look at each other super intensely, and the way that Brandon says he'll be driving Philip up to Connecticut as if they're used to doing things as a couple and used to doing things together like that. Just as well, the dynamic of the relationship where Brandon has a sort of control over Philip, which, you know, there's an implication that it's also potentially sexual and it's manipulative as well, but it's clear that Philip is under this sort of spell of Philip, even if he doesn't want to be. There's, for example, a particular scene which is said to be quite explicit. Again, this is explicit for the 1940s, so of course to us now in the 21st century, when we've seen a shitload of things, it's not as shocking as it probably was, but obviously everything is very much shrouded. But there is a scene where Philip asks Brandon how he felt during the murder. And, okay, he doesn't explicitly refer to the murder. He leaves it very open because he technically doesn't refer to the murder. He says he calls it it, and it leaves a lot to the imagination. And then Brandon talks about how he felt tremendously exhilarated. And then there's a moment where Brandon turns to look at Philip and asks him with a very, very deep intensity, how did you feel? And they're just looking at each other with a very, very intense intimacy and openness. And the reason people have referred to this as being quite explicit is because it's almost as if they're describing a post-sex feeling. And honestly, if you look at it, it really feels that way too. It seems like they're both a little bit flustered, a little out of breath, very excited, exhilarated. And so I'm not surprised that people in the 40s were a bit like, whoa, what is happening? This made some moviegoers really uncomfortable because in the 1940s, homosexuality was highly frowned upon and it was controversial. It was seen as something disgusting, immoral, indecent, obscene, you name it. Gay people weren't even seen as people. And so to have this staring them in the face was a bit of a shock, to say the least. Now, in the original play, the characters were explicitly in a relationship. And also, the crime which it is based upon and the original killers in this event were also lovers. It was also the people who were involved in the movie which added to the idea of the movie leaning towards homosexuality. Because Folly Granger was bisexual, John Dahl was gay, and then the screenwriter Arthur Lawrence was gay, openly gay. Even the crew of the movie were aware of this homosexual element, and they never referred to it out loud, but they always called it. The gay relationship, the gay subtext, that gay tension was referred to as it, and people were very aware of it, even though they would never say it out loud, never refer to it out loud. It was it. And supposedly, Rupert's character was also gay. I mean, in the original play, he was. But there is no indication that he is gay in the movie. It isn't really known if James Stewart knew about the pretty obvious homosexual subtext, but it is assumed that he wasn't, because I believe that James Stewart is quite a conservative and he probably wouldn't have been psyched to learn about that. I was prompted to watch this movie because I'd read somewhere that this was supposedly an LGBTQI+ movie somehow, and I was like, yeah, no dice. And when I watched it, I expected something super small, barely perceivable, that people just built into something. But holy smokes, was I taken aback. I mean, even though it's meant to be very subtle, I totally got relationship vibes from Brandon and Philip. For me, it was so evident, really. And it really shocked me because I was like, holy shit, this movie is from 1948. And to me, these people are clearly in a relationship. And I find it so interesting to watch the movie knowing the implications meant by the behavior and the actions of the characters. So it's a really, really interesting movie, especially considering the time and the themes and the symbols as well. It is also interesting to look at the relationship between Philip and Brandon, separate from the romantic element. It's a very striking relationship because they are just the complete opposite. You can't even imagine them being friends, let alone committing a murder together, which is just on another level, to be honest. Philip is exceedingly anxious and has a very hard time lying and pretending, whereas Brandon is utterly smooth and calm, making conversation, being really sociable and everything. And instead of deflecting any suspicion, like Philip does, well, he tries to do, but he obviously doesn't because he's very obvious, Brandon encourages it almost, as if he wants to be found out, or as if he has so much confidence that he wouldn't be found out, that he doesn't care how obvious he was because he just thought he was untouchable. Well, Brandon is not as completely untouchable as he thinks, as his guests start becoming more suspicious. The flakiness of the situation and the way that the layers of their deed are slowly being unshed is represented during a scene where Miss Wilson, their maid, is steadily removing the dishes from the makeshift table. So she's removing the dishes, the tablecloth, and everything. This is very unimportant to the others, who barely notice what she's doing and are having a very animated discussion. They're talking about where David could be, what he's doing, why he hasn't phoned. And instead of focusing on the characters who are having this conversation and switching from one to the other, the camera stays rooted to one spot, filming something which seems to be unimportant to everybody else in the room, which is that she's taking off the plates, the silverware, the tablecloth, but that we as the viewers know that she's so close to opening the chest with the dead body of David in there. And because she's planning to put the books that they've taken out back in the chest. So nobody else thinks that what she's doing is in any way weird at all or interesting, but we as the audience are just hooked. And the camera focuses on that because it knows as well as we do, the audience, that in there is the body. Now listen, during this whole scene, I was gaping like a fish. My heart was hammering uncontrollably in my chest. I just couldn't even imagine Miss Wilson suddenly opening that chest and finding David's dead body. I was just almost to the verge of actually shouting or something. I was shaking and everything. And it actually gets to the point where Miss Wilson actually lifts the top of the chest slightly when Brandon glides in very casually and says, "Oh, Miss Wilson, you don't need to do that. I'll put books back later." When Brandon glides in casually saying that Miss Wilson doesn't have to trouble herself in opening the chest and putting the books back in, I felt like the sensation of relief. And I realized that I had been caught in exactly what Hitchcock intended, which was the sense of relief. And this basically aligns the audience more with Brandon and Philip because of this heightened sense of anxiety we feel during this moment where that they're going to be discovered all of a sudden. But honestly, that scene was absolutely insane. I had my heart beating out of my chest. It was seriously a relief. I don't know why it was, because I don't support and I don't like Brandon and Philip at all. And I obviously think what they did was horrific, but I still felt that sense of relief when they didn't find the body. I don't know why, you know? I guess that just shows how we as the audience can be so easily manipulated. So now to move on to some symbols. So one of the prominent symbols is that of the metronome. And at one point during the party, Philip goes to play the piano to ground himself. He's been very jittery, very nervous, and he needs to play the piano just to get a sense of calmness. And Rupert follows him and starts asking him questions because at this point, Rupert is quite suspicious. And as Rupert starts talking, he starts the metronome. Rupert himself starts the metronome, and the constant ticking of the metronome and the questions put forth by Rupert heighten Philip's sense of anxiety. Philip is totally out of sync with the piano, just as his nervous and scared behavior is totally out of sync with the casual and light-hearted dinner party. The constant ticking of the metronome also symbolizes time ticking away and how it would only be a matter of time before Brandon and Philip are found out. Another symbol is light. Philip and Brandon murder David in the middle of the day, even though the blinds are closed. Now, after the murder, Brandon goes to open the blinds, but Philip says, "Not yet." The fact that Brandon doesn't shy away from the light shows that he feels like he's superior. Almost as if the light that Brandon decides to let in is like a spotlight on him, and even though he committed murder in broad daylight, he won't be caught. Whereas Philip's reluctance about being in the light, seen after he asks Brandon not to open the blinds yet, shows that he's scared and ashamed of what he did. Now, another very, very important and prominent element in the movie is irony. And this is what makes the movie even more disturbing and intense, in my opinion. The whole movie itself is based off the dramatic irony of the guests wandering and asking where David is and why he's late, when all the time he is in the room with them under their very noses. I mean, that is just the most ironic thing, and it's just so powerful because you hear them talking about it, and they're people who you know care about Brandon so much, and you as a stranger know that he's dead in that wooden chest, and these people that love him so much don't even know that he's there dead in the room. It's absolutely insane. I mean, that's one of the things that really got to me when I watched this movie. And then there's the irony that Brandon is absolutely convinced that they've committed the perfect murder. But in the end, they give themselves away. They're the ones who ruin this idea of the perfect murder because they're found out by Rupert in the end. So irony really forms one of the main foundations of the movie and the source of discomfort and feelings of anxiety throughout the whole movie. Now, I'm reaching the end of this episode, but there are just so many things to say about this movie, and they're all more interesting than the other. But I think I've already been going on for too long, so I just want to say that I really enjoy this movie. The tension, the absolutely super disturbing philosophical justification behind the murder, the characters, the co-relationship between Brandon and Philip, the extent to which Rupert can be considered guilty. There's so much to think about and so much to talk about. It was just a thrill. It was a thrill watching this movie and talking about it. So I just want to say thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you have a very lovely evening. And please take care of yourselves in these kind of weird moments and wash your hands. Bye-bye.